Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
President Barack Obama is in City Hall in Oslo, Norway. He says he humbly accepts his Nobel Peace Prize.
Compared to some of the giants of history who have received this prize, Schweitzer and King, Marshall and Mandela, my accomplishments are slight.
But the president also says the pacifism of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., Gandhi, and others may not have been practical or even possible in every circumstance. A new American argument to wage war in order to protect us and produce peace. It's a takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 10th. The takeaway is whether we're more at peace now with the decision to award Barack Obama the Nobel Peace Prize than we were when they announced the decision.
Well, you can hear him in the speech, and it's still actually going on in Oslo, grappling with this issue of being a global superpower, being at war, and yet needing to project leadership for world
peace.
Right.
Is he at peace with it? Mm-hmm. President Obama has accepted his Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo.
I receive this honor with deep gratitude and great humility. It's an award that speaks to our highest aspirations, that for all the cruelty and hardship of our world, we are not mere prisoners of fate. Our actions matter and can bend history in the direction of justice.
But directly after those words in his acceptance speech, Barack Obama conceded the irony of winning the prize while leading a nation in the midst of two wars, and he asked for international partners to help him reach for the world that ought to be. We're speaking now with Charlie Sennett, executive editor of the Global Post. Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning.
You've heard the initial opening remarks from President Obama. Anything in here that surprises you?
No, I think it's a very, very powerful speech. I think this section where he really gets into the nitty-gritty about how sometimes we have to accept that violence is necessary to avoid greater violence is really where you get at it. And I think this example of how to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons, where he begins to specifically mention Iran and North Korea and describes them as trying to, quote, game the system, I think that is where the real crux of this speech is headed now in terms of what he is setting out as what he needs to accomplish to deserve this award.
Charlie, he seems to have decided to immediately, from almost the get-go, address the issue of not only the controversy over his so-called lack of accomplishments in peace, but also the issue of him being accepting the Nobel Peace Prize while he leads a country into war.
He is. I think this is a very powerful speech by one of the best orators we've ever had in the White House. I mean, he's as good as Reagan. He's as good as Kennedy, if not better. And this line, to say that force is sometimes necessary is not a call to cynicism. It is a recognition of history, the imperfections of man. This is a speech with great sweep and historic value.
Okay, Charlie Sennett is the executive editor of the Global Post. We'll be talking with you more in just a moment. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Robert Gates landed in Baghdad this morning. He arrived only hours after a group linked to Al-Qaeda claimed responsibility for the car bombings 2 days ago that killed 127 people. And five young Muslim American men detained in Pakistan are believed to be the same five men who vanished from the Washington, D.C. last month.
A couple of other stories. Home foreclosures were down again last month, an 8% decrease. The recount is over in Atlanta. Kasim Reed is the next mayor of that city. His election extends a decades-long line of African-American mayors in the city of Atlanta. Asian markets ended lower. European indices are up in afternoon trading. Futures are mixed. The Dow will get underway in about 90 minutes at 10,337. The S&P is 5 points below 1,100, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,183. Well, besides delivering a lecture of extraordinary historic import and sweep, as Charlie Sennett suggests, what does Barack Obama need to do to truly deserve this Nobel Peace Prize? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We want to know what you think.
We'll be covering the president's speech and the reactions to it more all this hour.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. President Barack Obama is in Oslo. He has accepted his Nobel Peace Prize, and we will join now his continuing remarks.
The Second World War. In the wake of devastation, they recognize that if human rights are not protected, peace is a hollow promise. And yet too often, these words are ignored. For some countries, the failure to uphold human rights is excused by the false suggestion that these are somehow Western principles, foreign to local cultures or stages of a nation's development. And within America, there's long been a tension between those who describe themselves as realists or idealists, a tension that suggests a stark choice between the narrow pursuit of interests or an endless campaign to impose our values around the world. I reject these choices. I believe that peace is unstable where citizens are denied the right to speak freely or worship as they please, choose their own leaders, or assemble without fear. Pent-up grievances fester, and the suppression of tribal and religious identity can lead to violence. We also know that the opposite is true. Only when Europe became free did it finally find peace. America has never fought a war against a democracy, and our closest friends are governments that protect the rights of their citizens. No matter how callously defined, neither America's interests nor the world's are served by the denial of human aspirations. So even as we respect the unique culture and traditions of different countries, America will always be a voice for those aspirations that are universal. We will bear witness to the quiet dignity of reformers like Aung San Suu Kyi, to the bravery of Zimbabweans who cast their ballots in the face of beatings, to the hundreds of thousands who have marched silently through the streets of Iran. It is telling that the leaders of these governments fear the aspirations of their own people more than the power of any other nation. And it is the responsibility of all free people and free nations to make clear that these movements of hope and history, they have us on their side. Let me also say this. The promotion of human rights cannot be about exhortation alone. At times, it must be coupled with painstaking diplomacy. I know that engagement with repressive regimes lacks the satisfying purity of indignation. But I also know that sanctions without outreach, condemnation without discussion, can carry forward only a crippling status quo. No repressive regime can move down a new path unless it has the choice of an open door. In light of the Cultural Revolution's horrors, Nixon's meeting with Mao appeared inexcusable. And yet it surely helped set China on a path where millions of its citizens have been lifted from poverty and connected to open societies. Pope John Paul's engagement with Poland created space not just for the Catholic Church, but for labor leaders like Lech Walesa. Ronald Reagan's efforts on arms control and embrace of perestroika not only improved relations with the Soviet Union, but empowered dissidents throughout Eastern Europe. There's no simple formula here, but we must try as best we can to balance isolation and engagement, pressure and incentives, so that human rights and dignity are advanced over time. Third, a just peace includes not only civil and political rights, it must encompass economic security and opportunity. For true peace is not just freedom from fear, but freedom from want. It is undoubtedly true that development rarely takes root without security. It is also true that security does not exist where human beings do not have access to enough food or clean water or the medicine and shelter they need to survive. It does not exist where children can't aspire to a decent education or a job that supports a family. The absence of hope can rot a society from within. And that's why helping farmers feed their own people or nations educate their children and care for the sick is not mere charity. It's also why the world must come together to confront climate change. There's little scientific dispute that if we do nothing, we will face more drought, more famine, more mass displacement, all of which will fuel more conflict for decades. For this reason, it's not merely scientists and environmental activists who call for swift and forceful action. It's military leaders in my own country and others who understand our common security hangs in the balance. Agreements among nations, strong institutions, support for human rights, investments in development. All these are vital ingredients in bringing about the evolution that President Kennedy spoke about. And yet, I do not believe that we will have the will, the determination, the staying power to complete this work without something more. And that's the continued expansion of our moral imagination. An insistence that there's something irreducible that we all share. As the world grows smaller, you might think it would be easier for human beings to recognize how similar we are, to understand that we're all basically seeking the same things, that we all hope for the chance to live out our lives with some measure of happiness and fulfillment for ourselves and our families. And yet, somehow, given the dizzying pace of globalization, the cultural leveling of modernity, it perhaps comes as no surprise that people fear the loss of what they cherish in their particular identities, their race, their tribe, and perhaps most powerfully, their religion. In some places, this fear has led to conflict. At times, it even feels like we're moving backwards. We see it in the Middle East as the conflict between Arabs and Jews seems to harden. We see it in nations that are torn asunder by tribal lines. And most dangerously, we see it in the way that religion is used to justify the murder of innocents by those who have distorted and defiled the great religion of Islam and who attacked my country from Afghanistan. These extremists are not the first to kill in the name of God. The cruelties of the Crusades are amply recorded. But they remind us that no holy war can ever be a just war. For if you truly believe that you are carrying out divine will, then there is no need for restraint, no need to spare the pregnant mother, or the medic, or the Red Cross worker, or even a person of one's own faith. Such a warped view of religion is not just incompatible with the concept of peace, but I believe it's incompatible with the very purpose of faith. For the one rule that lies at the heart of every major religion is that we do unto others as we would have them do unto us.
Words of President Barack Obama speaking, accepting the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo at City Hall. We'll have more coverage. Stay with us. So with the words, let us reach for the world that ought to be, we go now to the conclusion of President Barack Obama's acceptance speech for the Nobel Peace Prize.
Somewhere today, in the here and now, in the world as it is, a soldier sees he's outgunned but stands firm to keep the peace. Somewhere today, in this world, a young protester awaits the brutality of her government but has the courage to march on. Somewhere today, a mother facing punishing poverty
still takes the time to teach her child, scrapes together what few coins she has to send that child to school, because she believes that a cruel world still has a place for that child's dreams. Let us live by their example. We can acknowledge that oppression will always be with us and still strive for justice. We can admit the intractability of deprivation and still strive for dignity. Clear-eyed, we can understand that there will be war and still strive for peace. We can do that, for that is the story of human progress. That's the hope of all the world. And at this moment of challenge, that must be our work here on Earth. Thank you very much.
The conclusion there, Barack Obama accepting the Nobel Peace Prize, the lecture he gave at Oslo City Hall before an audience of about 1,000 people, ending with those stirring words, but a speech that was filled with the sort of grappling ironies of being a commander-in-chief involved in two battlefields, one war that we did not ask for, he says, referring to Afghanistan, another war, Iraq, which, of course, was something that was initiated by the United States.
And he didn't especially sugarcoat anything. There were some harsh realities in his speech about war and about whether or not we could live in a world that where it was completely peaceful.
And a fairly comprehensive evocation of history, referring to the Marshall Plan, referring to the League of Nations, referring to Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela,
the Catholic Church in Poland,
Albert Schweitzer,
yeah.
an enormous scope, as Charlie Sennett, who has been our guest all morning, executive editor of GlobalPost.com, noted. Charlie, initial reactions?
I think it was a very powerful, important, and historic speech. I thought it was very self-effacing. I mean, he, as you pointed out, you know, he went right into that enormous irony looming that here is the man receiving the Peace Prize who is conducting two wars and escalating one of them. I thought it also had a very stirring defense of America's history and sacrificing for peace from World War II to Kosovo. I thought the biggest takeaway for me, though, was a telegraphing of the challenges that he sees as what he needs to do to really have earned this award, and that is setting up the idea that there's going to have to be a tougher enforcement to prevent nuclear proliferation. And I thought when he went into the idea of the history of talking with the enemy, which has a great tradition from John Paul II to Reagan with the Soviets, Nixon with China, he said we have to balance isolation and engagement. That might as well be a direct message to Iran, to North Korea, and even on a smaller level to Hamas and to the Taliban.
But there needs to be an open door. There needs to be
an
open door for repressive nations.
Right.
He said that almost a direct quote. Charlie Sennett, executive editor of GlobalPost.com. Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations. You've heard the speech as we heard it. Is this an academic speech or a call to action in your view?
Well, a bit of both. It was a serious speech. It was an attempt to have a serious conversation about some of the tensions or dilemmas of running a foreign policy in this era of history. I thought, for example, the challenge to the world, basically saying if you don't want force to be the only remedy to deal with nuclear proliferation, you would better back robust sanctions against countries like North Korea and Iran. That was, to me, in some ways, the most interesting part of the speech. It was also a speech that tried to defend the president against his domestic critics on foreign policy, who basically said he was carrying out a foreign policy that didn't talk enough or do enough in the human rights area. So he basically tried to make the case that engagement with tyrants is sometimes necessary, and over time it can be the best way to bring about more open societies. But those were the best parts of the speech, because they were an attempt to grapple with the serious dilemmas of carrying out a comprehensive foreign policy.
You know, Richard, he evokes the mechanism of achieving peace in an unusual way. He talked about the top-down kinds of issues that you just referred to there, running a foreign policy. But he also talked about grassroots, the sort of small peace prizes that are granted in individual villages and people who are working for peace in their sort of small locations. Do you think that works?
It's probably somewhat rhetorical at one level. On the other hand, take the Middle East. The top-down approach in the Middle East right now between the Israelis and the Palestinians is not working at all. But perhaps the one reason not to be filled with despair, the one positive thing going on between Israelis and Palestinians is what's happening on the ground. the fact that you're beginning to see Palestinian institutions develop. The Palestinian economy is now growing at 6 or 7 or 8%. Palestinian police forces being built up. Israeli checkpoints are being reduced. It's not sexy, grand stuff, but it is a ground-up approach. And in the long run, that actually may have more to do with the future of whether Israelis and Palestinians can live together than any number of special envoys.
Is this speech a fair reflection of the actual Barack Obama foreign policy, or is it a bit of a show piece for the global audience?
Well, I think it's a good question. It's an attempt to explain the fact that the foreign policy isn't simply one-dimensional, that at times you do have to use force, at times you do have to talk to bad guys. It's in that sense, it's a grown-up speech that tries to deal with some of the very real dilemmas, contradictions, tensions of carrying out a global foreign policy.
All right, we're going to take a look at the Middle East coming up at this hour. Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, thanks so much for being with us, Richard. Charlie Sennett, executive editor of GlobalPost.com, thanks to you as well. And we are asking all of you for your reactions, and we'll share them with our audience the rest of the hour. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And this question, what does Barack Obama actually have to do? He's laid it out for himself in the speech.
Absolutely.
To deserve this Nobel Peace Prize. You're listening to The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, more reactions, including your reactions to President Obama's Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech in just a few moments. First, let's check in on some of the other stories we're covering this morning at 30 minutes after the hour. As the president accepted the Peace Prize, he spoke a lot about Afghanistan, a war he said the U.S. did not seek. He confirmed the U.S. would begin a transition period in 2011. Earlier, that same comment was made by Defense Secretary Robert Gates.
While we hope and expect to begin transferring security responsibility in July of 2011, we will have a large number of forces here for some period beyond that.
Meanwhile, yesterday, General David Petraeus, commander of U.S. Central Command, told senators to expect a tough year ahead in Afghanistan.
Achieving progress in Afghanistan will be hard, and the progress there likely will be slower in developing than was the progress achieved in Iraq.
Progress in Iraq remains challenging as well, though. This morning, a group linked to al-Qaeda claimed responsibility for the car bombings 2 days ago that killed 127 people and wounded more than 500.
A story in Pakistan and Washington. Pakistani authorities are interrogating five young Muslim American men, the same five believed to have vanished from the Washington, D.C. area last month. Relatives say a disturbing apparently farewell video was left behind. The FBI are investigating the case. More details expected later. More now on a story we told you about yesterday. The government of Ireland unveiled a record $6 billion in budget cuts, slashing pay for state workers, cut welfare benefits, imposed taxes on fuel. The public sector in that country is a fifth of the economy. The Dubai stock market has risen 7% today after heavy losses in recent days. Asian markets ended lower. European indices up in morning trading. Futures are mixed as the Dow gets underway later this morning at 10,337. The NASDAQ will open at 2183. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
At times, it even feels like we're moving backwards. We see it in the Middle East as the conflict between Arabs and Jews seems to harden. We see it in nations that are torn asunder by tribal lines. And most dangerously, we see it in the way that religion is used to justify the murder of innocents by those who have distorted and defiled the great religion of Islam and who attacked my country from Afghanistan.
That's President Barack Obama speaking just moments ago as he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in part for his efforts to engage the Muslim world. And in his speech earlier today, he accepted that award. But what about the rest of the Middle East? We're going to ask what the president has done right, wrong, and what he still has left to do in the Middle East. We have two guests to talk about that. We have Reza Aslan. He's a Middle East analyst and contributing editor to the online blog The Daily Beast. And Abdurrahim Fokhara is the D.C. Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera. Good morning.
Good morning.
That was one of the places, Abdurrahim, where he spoke about the Middle East at all. Were you expecting to hear some more from him?
I expected to hear something a little bit more direct about the issue of the Middle East. There were several indirect allusions to it. I found it really interesting that one of the first things that he hit was the concept of justice. And obviously that was going to be a running theme throughout the speech. The issue of justice with regard to the Middle East obviously has a true ring to it in the Middle East, especially on the Arab side, because they see, or they saw in him when he came to power, perhaps the best chance to get justice for the Palestinians.
And that's a good question for you, Reza Aslan. The Nobel Peace Prize Committee pointed to Barack Obama's outreach to the Muslim world as one of the reasons why he deserved this award. Now that we're a bit later on in the year, there are many Muslims who are expressing frustration or impatience over how far that outreach has gone. What do you think about that? Do you think that the journey ahead of him has to increase his outreach?
Well, I think the president definitely needs to be praised for the way that he has changed the very narrative of relations between the United States and Muslim-majority states, particularly in the Middle East. And that's no small matter after 8 years of a president who really saw the conflicts of the world in these civilizational terms, these clash of civilizations, if you will, between the West and Islamic civilizations. In some ways, he does need to be praised also for the way that he's reached out to Iran and the fact that his stubborn insistence on negotiations with that country has really exposed the fault lines in Iran. And it's had actually a remarkable effect within Iran, even though he's being criticized for it outside of Iran. But I think the reason that he didn't bring up the Israeli-Palestinian situation much more than just sort of a passing reference to it is because it's been a miserable failure on his part. After creating such massive expectations for a just peace between Israel and Palestine, he has, I think, displayed or proved what I think many people always realized, and that's that when it comes to the relationship between the United States and Israel, Israel wears the pants. I mean, to say to Israel in no uncertain terms, you must, without exception, immediately cease all settlement activity, and to have the Israelis say to him no, and to basically have nothing in response, is to show an enormous amount of weakness. So I think that's really where his greatest failing when it comes to the Middle East lies, is in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Abdurrahim, I want you to listen on this very topic to a call from one of our listeners, Troy in North Dakota.
Good morning, Troy from North Dakota. I think everyone is thinking it, but also hesitant to say it because it's too monolithic of a burden to place on a person. But I believe that Obama's challenge is to be that shepherd who brings about a lasting peace agreement in Israel-Palestine. I hope and pray that he is that leader.
What do you think, Abdurrahim? Is that...
Well, you know, the problem of President Barack Obama with the Middle East is that he created a lot of expectation. As the caller said, a lot of people in the Middle East thought, this is it. This is the man who's going to do something about the Middle East issue. And I take you all back to that famous meeting that he had with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House after Netanyahu's first visit to Washington. And he was clear, and he said the issue of Palestine should be top of the agenda. And he was clear about the issue of settlement. Settlement, he said, must freeze at a time when there was international consensus that unless you sorted out the issue of Israeli settlement in the West Bank, you're not going to get a deal. And then we saw backpedaling on that on the part of the administration, saying Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has offered to freeze the settlement for 10 months, and that's a really an unprecedented measure, and the Palestinians should go along with that and start direct negotiations with the Israelis. So the gripe that the people in the Middle East now have with President Barack Obama is not so much that he is unable to solve the problem. They've been used to that with previous U.S. administrations. It's the fact that he made a promise that he doesn't seem to be able to stick to.
The narrative of the settlements policy in Israel and the occupied territories, of course, is a long one, and that's really not the subject of Barack Obama's speech. And we should say the people of Israel are in the Middle East, and they might not have the same gripe that others might have. But are both of you saying that the failure on the part of Barack Obama to even make a veiled reference to Israel in this speech is a failure of the speech and of his policy? Reza, you first.
I think that it's, you know, it's an embarrassment. It's a source of embarrassment, really. Let's make it very clear. This was to be the hallmark of his foreign policy with the Middle East. To say that he had grand expectations is a bit of an understatement. And it's been such an absolute miserable failure on his part that to bring it up would be to be laughed out of the hall.
Okay, Reza Aslan is the Middle East analyst and contributing editor to The Daily Beast, and Abdurrahim Fukara is the D.C. bureau chief for Al Jazeera. Thank you both for joining us. More on President Obama's speech from Oslo coming up. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry.
We must begin by acknowledging a hard truth. We will not eradicate violent conflict in our lifetimes.
There's President Barack Obama speaking this morning as he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo and delivered his acceptance lecture there at Oslo City Hall. As if, not literally, of course, to answer that speech, however, we're going to take a look at a story that's developing in Pakistan and in Washington, D.C. Police in Pakistan say five U.S. nationals have been arrested after being suspected of planning attacks against American interests in Pakistan. We go now to Aleem Maqbool, Islamabad correspondent for our partner, the BBC, who is following the story from Islamabad, Pakistan. We've already talked about this from the U.S. angle. Our partners at the New York Times are reporting that the FBI is apparently in Pakistan, but possibly has not had access to these five individuals. What do we know at this point, Aleem Maqbool?
What we're talking about is five men believed to be between the ages of 19 and 25. They're now in custody in the Punjabi city of Sargodha. What we're being told by the local police here is that FBI team has now interrogated this group of people. That isn't, I have to say, being confirmed as yet by the American embassy here in Islamabad. But the police are saying that these five people have been interrogated not only by Pakistani intelligence services, but also by the FBI, and that both organizations are sharing the intelligence. And these people were arrested in a raid on a house late on Wednesday used by an Islamist militant group. The police are not saying exactly what they're charged. They haven't been formally charged as yet, but what they're suspected of planning to attack. But they believe that they are a threat, but they're at the moment examining computer hard drives and some of the literature that these people had in their possession.
No indication, Aleem Maqbool, at this point that explosives were found or confiscated by the authorities. And as you say, this precise notion of the attack is right now not public.
No, they haven't said that. But remember, we're talking about a group of five people that were reported missing in the States late last month. Again, it's something that's not been confirmed by the American embassy as yet, but the Pakistani police have said that they have now made this connection, that these five people that they've caught are the very five whose families reported them missing in late November. They had been worried and had asked for help in finding these five people because they'd found a leaving video. That's what's being reported. A leaving video was found in the States. They're all supposed to be from the Washington, D.C. or Northern Virginia area, at least. In this video, there were scenes of conflict and a message that could be construed as a sort of goodbye message.
Martyrdom.
Calling for young Muslims to rise up. So clearly there are worries about these men. But as I say, they haven't been formally charged as yet. But what the police here are saying is that if they do find more evidence of extremist links, then of course they will be charged within 2 weeks.
Well, that's the issue. Aleem Maqbool, what would transform this from a sort of disturbing kind of travelogue and actual recruitment for terrorist activities? So that would be the next step here, right?
Yeah, well, clearly links with Al-Qaeda would be extremely worrying, and the kind of militants they met, whether they were here for training purposes to return to the United States or whether it was to carry out acts here. But as yet, this is all speculation. We're still waiting for hard evidence.
But very interesting questions. Aleem Maqbool, BBC Islamabad correspondent. We're covering this from both the Washington, D.C. angle and the Pakistan angle. Aleem Maqbool from our partner, the BBC, of course. The story of five men detained in Pakistan, disappeared from Washington, D.C. Motives and tactics yet unknown. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, the former House Speaker Newt Gingrich reacts to President Obama's Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech in Oslo. What do you think, though?
B. Wilkes, Memphis, Tennessee. I don't think that Obama has earned the Nobel Peace Prize, and it takes away from the very works that many of those who've been awarded the Peace Prize have done, and it really degrades the work that Dr. King did.
So what will he need to do to deserve it? Is it nuclear disarmament? Does he need to win a second term? Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
But let's check leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. Up to date on the proceedings in Oslo in the past hour, President Obama gave an address described as a lecture after receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. He spoke of his gratitude and humility, said others might be more deserving, but also spoke about the two wars currently being waged by the United States, saying he had an acute sense of the cost of armed conflict. He called the war in Afghanistan a just war. And concluding his acceptance speech, President Obama praised Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King. He said the love they preached should always be the goal of foreign policy and of struggles for world peace. The president was awarded the prize for what the organizers described as his extraordinary efforts to strengthen international diplomacy and to push for nuclear disarmament. In other news, five American men are being held in Pakistan. They come from the Washington, D.C. area. Relatives say a disturbing farewell video was left before the men vanished from D.C. around a month ago. Authorities in Pakistan say the men are being interrogated.
The first direct talks between the North Koreans and the Obama administration have ended. North Korea has not agreed to return to multilateral talks on giving up its nuclear weapons. The U.S. envoy to North Korea is Stephen Bosworth.
It is certainly our hope, based on these discussions in Pyongyang, that the six-party talks can resume expeditiously and that we can get back to the important work of denuclearization.
Bosworth gave no timeline, though. Here at home, blizzards have swept the Midwest. Weathermen in Ohio saw record snowfalls. The storm has claimed the lives of at least 16 people. And the latest numbers on foreclosures show improvement. While the rate is still considerably higher than a year ago, Realty Track says the number of households receiving a foreclosure-related notice in November dropped 8% from October. That's the fourth straight monthly decline. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So we're going to spend the rest of the hour with former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Of course, he led the Republican Revolution when he was Speaker of the House from 1995 to 1999. These days, he's organizing various sorts of policy events, including the Real Jobs Summit, which is in reaction to President Obama's Jobs Summit that he talked about last week. First of all, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, good morning.
No, it's good to be with you.
Mr. Gingrich, let's talk first of all about the speech in Oslo, if we might. I mean, he evoked a lot of history in there. It reminded me actually of you, who are fond and a student of American history. Do you think his depiction and characterization of American leadership as important in the world is viable, and is he carrying it out in his foreign policy?
Yeah, I think that he is I thought the speech was actually very good. You know, and he clearly understood that he had been given the prize prematurely, but he used it as an occasion to remind people, first of all, as he said, that there's evil in the world. I mean, I think having a liberal president who goes to Oslo on behalf of a peace prize and reminds the committee that they would not be free, they wouldn't be able to have a peace prize without having force. You know, the history of Nazi Germany, the history of Stalin's Soviet Union, the history of Al-Qaeda. I thought in some ways it's a very historic speech, and the president, I think, did a very good job of representing the role of America, which has been that of, at the risk of lives of young Americans, creating the fabric of security within which you could have a Martin Luther King Jr. or you could have a Mahatma Gandhi. But without the power of organized force, Mahatma Gandhi would have been killed by somebody like Adolf Hitler, and Martin Luther King Jr. would have been killed by the segregationist without the protection of the United States government.
Well, I want to talk about the difference between sort of rhetorical persuasion and actual on-the-ground policy changes, which is really what your Real Job Summit is all about. But, you know, I thought this speech interestingly bookended the Ronald Reagan era, in the sense that while he had nothing to do with the Nobel Peace Prize, he called for nuclear disarmament in the same way that Barack Obama has. He also called for force as an instrument of peace in the way that Barack Obama has in this speech. Were you surprised by that?
Well, look, I think Reagan always felt that nuclear weapons were inherently horrendously dangerous because if they're ever used, the number of people they'll kill in a very short period of time will be so unbelievably destructive, both at a human level and in terms of our freedoms. And so he always had a desire to find some way to get to a nuclear-free world. I think in that sense, there is a parallel between President Obama. The difference in part is that Reagan was a very realistic, very cautious person who said, trust but verify. He understood that there would be a huge incentive for dictatorships and others to try to cheat on any kind of agreement. And he was actually very, very good at being serious about detailed change. He also, remember, wanted to build the Strategic Defense Initiative because he thought you had to be able to defend yourself against any breakout with nuclear weapons. And, in fact, he turned down an enormous offer by Gorbachev, which would have achieved many of his idealistic goals, but would have required him to give up defending America from ballistic missiles. And he said he wouldn't do it because, in the end, you couldn't just trust. You also had to be able to defend yourself if the trust failed.
Let's talk about that realism. Listen to this clip from the speech, and I want to get your reaction and talk about the job summit. Hold on.
The ideals of liberty and self-determination, equality, and the rule of law have haltingly advanced. We are the heirs of the fortitude and foresight of generations past. And it is a legacy for which my own country is rightfully proud. And yet, a decade into a new century, this old architecture is buckling under the weight of new threats.
A little standing on the shoulders of giants rhetoric there from the president. Do you think he's helping to change the old architecture, or is he just simply passively responding to events? Newt Gingrich? He seems to have left us. Perhaps he had to go off to the jobs summit this morning. But in any case, Newt Gingrich
does have a busy schedule.
Does have a busy schedule today. Maybe a little too busy for us. Hopefully that wasn't a technical issue. I don't want to be unfair to Newt Gingrich. But anyway, talking about the president, let's wrap up here at the end of the hour. President Barack Obama accepting the Nobel Peace Prize there in Oslo. Interesting parallels. Newt Gingrich was talking about them with the Reagan era. Also, Richard Haass of the Council on Foreign Relations talking about the tremendous stakes that are in play here all of a sudden.
I think one of the things that stuck out to me in President Obama's speech was the fact that he directly addressed a couple things. Very early on in the speech, he not only acknowledged that the United States was a country at war, but he reminded NATO allies, including Norway, that they themselves were involved in the war in Afghanistan as well. And he later on went on to address critics of war. He said in many countries, there's a disconnect between the efforts of those who serve and the ambivalence of the broader public.
We've got former House Speaker Newt Gingrich back again. I'm glad you didn't leave. It was a technical problem. Speaker Gingrich, and you can evoke your job summit if you like. Compare the rhetorical flourishes of Barack Obama to this sense of realism of having to actually achieve something over the next 4 years.
Well, the answer is we don't know.
But do you see in the policies that are developing? I mean, you talk about this job summit at your own job summit this week that President Obama referred to last week, using green jobs to get unemployed people back to work. Do you think that's realistic, or is it more rhetorical flourish?
Well, that part's rhetorical flourish. But if you look at, for example, in Afghanistan, he has followed up his statement about the importance of defeating evil with what had to be one of the hardest decisions of his presidency so far. And I think that in that sense, he's lived up to it. The problem he has at home is that the gap between reality and the worldview that he represents, the sort of secular socialist model of reality in which somehow if you pour enough money into bureaucracy, it'll trickle down and do some good. The fact is, if you want to create jobs, you have to focus on small business. If you focus on small business, you have to cut litigation, regulation, and taxation. All three of those things go against the Democratic Party's core values and core interest group. So they can have, you know, job summits and talk grandly about eventually someday creating these jobs of the future, but they can't talk about the steps it would take to create the jobs of the present because they're the exact opposite of what the Democratic Party's interest groups and their platform and ideology stand for.
Well, the speech in Oslo is done. The work of governing goes on. Newt Gingrich helping us to put it in context. President Barack Obama accepting the Nobel Peace Prize today. Newt Gingrich, former House Speaker, joined us from Washington. Thank you so much, sir.
And we're asking you what you think. Let us know your reaction at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Yeah.
reaching for the world from the city of Oslo.
Let us reach for the world that ought to be, that spark of the divine that still steers within each of our souls. Somewhere today, in the here and now, in the world as it is, a soldier sees he's outgunned but stands firm to keep the peace. Somewhere today, in this world, a young protester awaits the brutality of her government but has the courage to march on.
With most of his presidency left to experience, President Barack Obama accepts the Nobel Peace Prize and marches on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Thursday, December 10th, and The Takeaway this morning is weighing all the promises that peace prizes and their speeches deliver with the real challenges to actually make global change to bring peace to the world.
And the vision that the Nobel Peace Prize Committee spoke to when they announced this decision compared to some harsh realities that President Obama spoke about in his acceptance
speech. Well, let's get right to those harsh realities. Joining us is James Fallows, former presidential speechwriter and Atlantic Magazine contributor. James, first of all, good morning.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you.
You've heard the speech. Was there enough realism in there, given the challenges that Barack Obama had to even give this speech, given that he's got two wars going?
I was actually struck by its realism, in the sense that the first half of it was a defense of tools of war towards the end of peace, and then the second talking about ways to build beyond that. So I thought that this was perhaps not the most memorable speech the president will ever have given, but appropriate to the occasion, and saying and recognizing and embracing the fact that he was there as a war president receiving a peace prize.
Indeed, and certainly a speech likely to be reviewed by historians depending on what happens in this 21st century. James Fallows, stay with us, former presidential speechwriter and Atlantic Magazine contributor. What will it take for Barack Obama to truly earn this prize? That's the subject of our discussion coming up. But first,
President Obama formally accepted the Nobel Peace Prize this morning in Oslo, as we said, while acknowledging the irony of winning it as a wartime president. He said,
"There will be times when nations, acting individually or in concert, will find the use of force not only necessary, but morally justified."
The president refused to renounce the two wars the U.S. finds itself in, saying defiantly, "I face the world as it is."
We must begin by acknowledging a hard truth. We will not eradicate violent conflict in our lifetimes.
Earlier, for reaction, we spoke to the Washington bureau chief for Al Jazeera, Abdurrahman Fakara, who was interested in the president's use of the word justice.
The issue of justice with regard to the Middle East obviously has a true ring to it, especially on the Arab side, because they saw in him, when he came to power, perhaps the best chance to get justice for the Palestinians.
In other news, five young Muslim American men detained in Pakistan are believed to be the same five men who vanished from Washington, D.C. last month. One of them had left a farewell video saying Muslims must be defended and featured images of American casualties. Numbers just out in the past half hour, the number of people filing first-time unemployment claims rose 17,000 last week. That's a weaker report than expected. And the U.S. trade deficit unexpectedly narrowed in October as exports surged to the highest level in nearly a year.
And Dubai's stock market has risen 7% today after heavy losses in recent days. Futures are up. The Dow will get underway this morning at 10,337. But our main point of discussion this morning is reaction to the president's speech. We're covering the Nobel Peace Prize lecture that the president has just delivered within the last 2 hours. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE with your net notion of what he needs to do to earn it.
This is Nick from Brookline. I think that President Obama needs to solve the crisis between the Palestinians and the Israelites.
This is Jean from New Jersey. I do not believe President Obama has to do anything to earn the award. He has it. All he has to do is do his job.
What is that job? We'll talk more about President Obama's challenges after accepting the Nobel Peace Prize in just a moment.
But we're always looking for your takes at 8778-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Well, the president, when he was told he'd won the Nobel Peace Prize, said humbly he possibly didn't deserve it, but he went to Oslo today and accepted that prize and delivered a lecture, a speech to 1,000 people at Oslo City Hall, a speech that in some parts sounded like an address that could have been given by almost any U.S. president.
I, like any head of state, reserve the right to act unilaterally, if necessary, to defend my nation. Nevertheless, I am convinced that adhering to standards, international standards, strengthens those who do, and isolates and weakens those who don't. The world rallied around America after the 9/11 attacks and continues to support our efforts in Afghanistan because of the horror of those senseless attacks and the recognized principle of self-defense.
President Obama speaking in Oslo and accepting the Nobel Peace Prize, but there were many places and certainly the circumstances of Barack Obama's speech set him apart from other recipients, certainly other American recipients, being involved in two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, a Middle East peace policy that seems stymied at this point. And even though he has pledged to reduce, if not eliminate, nuclear weapons, that process is right now unclear where it goes from here. To react to the speech and to assess whether Barack Obama really deserves this award, or maybe what he needs to do to truly deserve this award. It's something we're asking you this morning at 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Or David Sanger, New York Times chief Washington correspondent, who joins us from Washington, D.C. David, good morning.
Good morning.
And James Fallows is still with us, former presidential speechwriter and Atlantic Magazine contributor. He's also on the line from Washington. James, thanks for being with us again.
My pleasure.
So, David Sanger, let's just get right into it. Your reaction to the speech?
You know, I thought it was an interesting effort by the president, and probably a largely successful one, to define something that has been somewhat elusive to us in the past year, which is what exactly is the Obama doctrine and how does it differ from the Bush doctrine? Because one of the things that, of course, has disappointed some of his supporters, particularly on the left side of the Democratic Party, was that they thought that they were electing an anti-war candidate. And of course, as president, he has just accelerated the commitment in Afghanistan, and he has continued apace, actually increased the pace of things like Predator strikes over the border and against al-Qaeda in Pakistan. And we heard today his explanation of why. He said outright that he believed that unilateral action was, and unilateral military action was, still often required, and that he would go do it. But you saw the word in that clip you used, John. He used the word international, which was something that you never heard from President Bush, who always reserved the right for the U.S. to act regardless of what the international opinion was. And I think that was his effort to shade American policy.
The Bush word would have been U.S. national interest rather than international standards,
right,
is your supposition there. Interesting.
Which I don't think Obama would have argued with necessarily,
right,
in an extreme case. But in cases like this, I think he's found the need, as he said, get the additional power that you get from international approval.
James Fallows, David Sanger there describes a set of explanations of what we might call Barack Obama's predicament right now. He's won the award, but he has many challenges ahead. Did you hear an Obama doctrine in this speech this morning?
I heard it less the Obama doctrine than I did sort of the Obama consciousness. I think that while this was not as sort of spectacular from U.S. standards as his speech in Philadelphia a year and a half ago on race relations, which essentially saved his presidential campaign, I think it was similar to the mindset that we saw in that speech, in his inaugural address, in his speech in Cairo to the Islamic world, in essentially taking two things struck me about it. One is the long view, saying this is a process of years and decades and the rest. And the other is what we used to call a sort of Niebuhrian consciousness. We could eventually call it an Obama consciousness, of recognizing contradictions, recognizing ultimate frailties in the human condition, but nonetheless insisting on steps X and Y and Z. And so I it did seem to me, I'm sure there will be doctrines which flow from this, but I was struck by this as being one more sort of chapter in the basic mindset and worldview of Barack Obama as he approaches a range of problems.
David Sanger of the New York Times, there's been much said about how Barack Obama will use the Nobel Peace Prize, whether it will help or hinder him. One of the things that I heard was, in many times, he seemed to be calling directly to his NATO allies to continue their support of the war in Afghanistan and maybe increase it. At one point, he specifically said, in a world in which threats are more diffuse and missions more complex, America cannot act alone.
You know, I think that he was getting at the European and American divide here. I was in Europe a week or so after the award was announced, And on shows like this one and just in conversations with Europeans, I was struck by the number of people who asked me whether the award itself would keep him from escalating in Afghanistan, which was clearly what many Europeans hoped. And you know, I didn't believe it would, and I think one of the reasons that this award is so problematic for him is that it creates a set of expectations abroad that I think he believes he can't meet, and it creates a political problem for him in the United States. I was also struck by the fact that when you think about who the awardees have been by the Nobel Committee in the past few years, many of them appear to reach or be awarded a Nobel Peace Prize for not being George Bush. You know, there was Al Gore got one for his environmental work. Mohammed El-Baradei and the IAEA, which stood up to President Bush during the run-up to the Iraq War, got one for their work, and now this one. And so the committee has sort of gone out of its way to pick people who they thought went opposite the Bush doctrine.
Interesting. Well, you know, that raises, listen to this clip, James Fallows, for a moment, because in some ways maybe he's making the argument here in his speech that he is not going to be guided or dissuaded to move forward by this Peace Prize.
I know that engagement with repressive regimes lacks the satisfying purity of indignation. But I also know that sanctions without outreach, condemnation without discussion, can carry forward only a crippling status quo.
So James Fallows, is there the seed of an Obama doctrine in there, or is he pretty much talking about the status quo of engagement with repressive regimes and talk of sanctions?
I think he was trying to give a sort of larger structure to that that engagement that's been underway for a while. And it was striking to me, following what David was saying, that he didn't mention, to my notice, either Al Gore or Jimmy Carter. Instead, reach back to previous Nobel laureates who'd been involved in the same sort of work he's trying to talk about, which is the long, slow institution building. So he was looking for a different sort of Nobel Peace Prize heritage.
The references there being the Marshall Plan, right?
Right, exactly.
And the League of Nations, which, of course, was a
and
failure.
And the Red Cross with the Rules of War, et cetera.
Indeed. Well, lots to talk about. Interesting. We're going to have to go here. But James Fallows, thanks so much. Former presidential speechwriter and Atlantic Magazine contributor reacting to Barack Obama's Nobel Peace Prize speech. And, of course, our dear friend David Sanger, New York Times chief Washington correspondent. Thanks to both of you. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's take a look at some headlines.
Reaction has been coming in for President Obama's Nobel Peace Prize speech. In the past half hour, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, speaking here on The Takeaway, described the president's address as historic.
The president, I think, did a very good job of representing the role of America, which has been that of, at the risk of lives of young Americans, creating the fabric of security within which you could have a Martin Luther King Jr. or you could have a Mahatma Gandhi.
Newt Gingrich speaking to us earlier. In Iraq, a group linked to Al-Qaeda has taken responsibility for this week's Baghdad bombings.
Back in the U.S., health care reform could open up to Medicare more uninsured Americans, and that's going to all be costed out today. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has sent his proposal, his so-called deal, to the Congressional Budget Office for a cost assessment. And an appeals court in Los Angeles takes up Roman Polanski case today. Lawyers are expected to argue that his 32-year-old sex case should be decided by a lower court judge without Polanski present. You may recall Polanski was arrested in Switzerland in September and is currently under house arrest. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, 10 days after the runoff election, Atlanta finally gets a mayor-elect. We'll have more on what that means for the Atlanta political machine in just a few minutes.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway, and we are covering all morning President Obama's Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, or lecture. It is it's formally termed a lecture. And we're joined again by Charlie Sennett, the executive editor of the Global Post. Charlie, I want you to listen to one particular thing that the president had to say in his speech.
Where force is necessary, we have a moral and strategic interest in binding ourselves to certain rules of conduct. And even as we confront a vicious adversary that abides by no rules, I believe the United States of America must remain a standard bearer in the conduct of war. That is what makes us different from those whom we fight.
This appears to be a relatively large departure from his predecessor in his office. And he mentioned several times these oblique references to not using torture and not participating in extreme measures to combat terrorism. What was your reaction to that particular part of the speech?
I think that's an extraordinary part of the speech, and I think it's really why I would call this an historic speech. You know, Richard Haass said this is a mature speech, and David Sanger said it's an interesting speech, and James Fallows said it's Obama consciousness. These are very smart people who I respect tremendously, but I feel like there's some hesitancy on the part of many of us to recognize this, the tremendous skill and oratorical power and intellectual capacity of this president. And I think what makes this speech historic is that, you know, I've covered the war in Afghanistan, I've covered the war in Iraq, I've covered insurgencies and terrorism, and I've never heard anyone more clearly articulate what is a just war and what is just peace in a struggle against terrorism. Although, very precise, very clear.
Although, Charlie, we should note the Nobel Peace Prize is not a forensics award. I mean, it's not for oratory, right?
That's true, but I think what made Reagan a historical figure was that he had the power to express what needed to be expressed in order to confront the challenges of his time. The same with Kennedy. And I think that oratory is sometimes what binds us together to see clearly in a time of great confusion and sort of the shadows of a conflict like the one we face against terrorism.
He also made one mention of an oblique mention of the Israeli-Pakistani conflict.
At times, it even feels like we're moving backwards. We see it in the Middle East as the conflict between Arabs and Jews seems to harden. We see it in nations that are torn asunder by tribal lines. And most dangerously, we see it in the way that religion is used to justify the murder of innocents by those who have distorted and defiled the great religion of Islam and who attacked my country from Afghanistan.
Charlie, Senator of the Global Post, did he need to say more about the Israeli-Pakistan conflict?
Yeah, he's weak on Israel-Palestine and has consistently failed to spell out the specifics of how he can jumpstart this stalled, really dead-in-the-water peace process. I put that process in big quotes because there is no peace process right now. But I do think this is one of the areas where he doesn't know where to go. There's a lot of confusion within his own State Department about what direction to take. I do think he's very confident about what he called the purpose of faith and how faith will come to play in what he believes is this way at trying to solve these problems. I do think that's a corner of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that's not often explored enough. Where are the moderates in the religious voices? How could he perhaps draw them out is something I'd love to hear him talk about. I never have heard him talk about it. And he is definitely weak on Israel-Palestine.
And I said Israeli-Pakistan and meant Israeli-Palestinian, of course. But we did have one listener who agreed with you. They felt like they really wanted to hear more from President Obama on this issue.
It's John McAuliffe from Tarrytown, New York. The problem that Barack Obama faces and we face is that his soaring rhetoric has wound up justifying policies that are not very different than George Bush's in Iraq and Afghanistan and also on normalization of relations with Cuba.
We heard some references earlier to this being the Obama doctrine and differentiating from the Bush doctrine. Did he differentiate himself from George W. Bush?
I think he does every time he speaks by virtue of engaging with the world, listening to the world, calling upon the world to work together toward trying to achieve these goals. I mean, that's very different than the disposition we saw in the Bush White House. Also, practical things. You know, Guantanamo closed. You have a situation where he recognizes that Iraq was a war that he wouldn't refer to as a just war. And we didn't hear him say that. But I think he was articulating that the war in Afghanistan is a just war and one that he will execute in a way that he will also effectively take this 30,000 troops as a surge and then begin to build down. And I think there is a fundamental difference.
I think there's a danger. I'm actually sympathetic to some extent with what that caller was saying there. I mean, there is a danger here that rhetoric ends up justifying the status quo. Guantanamo isn't closed yet, and Afghanistan war is escalated, and the Iraq war continues to go on. Do you think there's a danger here?
I think there's a consistency to American foreign policy from president to president. But I think sometimes oratory is what powers us toward change. That was true with Reagan. I mean, you could say that what Reagan was saying was not that much different than what Carter was saying. Policies were not that much different. But sometimes you need someone to articulate the way forward and get you there.
Well, one of our listeners actually is objecting to the question that we've been asking all morning long, and that is whether Barack Obama even deserves this award at all and needs to earn it.
This is Jennifer from Rhode Island. I resent a little bit, a lot, in fact, you're taking the position that he has to win an award that he's already been given. I don't think anyone has been given the Nobel Peace Prize and then told that they had to then go about earning it.
An interesting comment, though. I imagine that it's one that many people are feeling this morning. Charlie Sennett, thank you so much. So he's executive editor, of
Maybe
the Global
the speech
Post.
Is, the good speech is how you earn it, right, Charlie?
No. She said he doesn't have to earn
right,
it. He
true.
Won the prize. He's
true.
Got it. Case closed.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
From Oslo, Barack Obama goes on to Copenhagen, where the climate change talks are being dominated by something called the Danish Text. It's a mechanism for enforcing climate change rules, and it's circulating at Copenhagen and causing all kinds of controversy. We'll tell you about that in just a moment. But first, here are some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. While accepting the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo this morning, President Obama defended the use of military force to preserve peace.
Whatever mistakes we have made, the plain fact is this. The United States of America has helped underwrite global security for more than six decades with the blood of our citizens and the strength of our arms.
The international community, the president said, needs to work together to achieve peace.
Nevertheless, I am convinced that adhering to standards, international standards, strengthens those who do and isolates and weakens those who don't.
Before the speech, we spoke with Wangari Maathai, the 2004 Nobel Peace Prize winner, who said President Obama is a worthy recipient of the prize even at this point in his presidency.
The Nobel Peace Prize is not necessarily a prize because you have achieved peace. It is because you are working towards peace.
Also speaking on The Takeaway this morning, former Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich agreed there are parallels between the president's speech this morning and his comments about nuclear weapons and the position of former President Ronald Reagan.
Reagan always felt that nuclear weapons were inherently horrendously dangerous because if they're ever used, the number of people they'll kill in a very short period of time will be so destructive, both at a human level and in terms of our freedom.
In other news, numbers just out in the past hour, the number of people filing first-time unemployment claims rose 17,000 last week, a weaker report than expected. The U.S. trade deficit, however, unexpectedly shrunk in October. It looks like the markets are trending up a little bit. The Dow is up 50, the NASDAQ up about 13, the S&P up 6, mostly flat with a upward trend. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Energy efficiency.
More than just getting you to change a light bulb.
Climate change.
Renewable energy.
This is what the U.S. has committed. This is what the EU has committed for 2020.
What can I do about it?
Talking about the climate change talks going on in Copenhagen now, Barack Obama will visit there after his speech in Oslo. But yesterday we reported on this program that something called the Danish Text, a draft of a mechanism for actually enforcing climate change and reductions in carbon emissions, is circulating and causing controversy at the Copenhagen conference. And the reason it's causing controversy is because apparently a cabal, a small subcommittee of rich developed nations, would actually be in charge of that enforcement mechanism. It's obviously concerned officials from all other nations at the conference and is very much being talked about today. Richie Ahuja joins us. He's the Indian Program Manager with the Environmental Defense Fund, and he's a voice of the developing world. Richie, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, explain precisely what the problem is with this Danish text and the idea that you'd have an enforcement mechanism which is made up of developed countries, principally the United States and perhaps the economies of Japan and Europe.
Let me just take a step back. Basically, it is a text,
and it is not the final version. There will be multiple iterations of this. So from my lens, I'd say it's a strong text that's been put on the table and will be negotiated on. We are, after all, in a negotiation. And compliance is a central part and a difficult part to handle. And I imagine as we move forward, we'll see some sort of convergence on that as well. But it's a very critical part for all countries to come on board and manage compliance well.
Well, Richie Ahuja, there are reports that actually India and China participated in possibly the draft of the so-called Danish text. But I'm wondering how the Indian government views this issue of compliance and how it will be enforced.
Well, from the Indian standpoint at the moment, from where they stand, it is their stance is that for the domestic actions, they will do the internal MRV, the monitoring, reporting, and verification. And for any work that is funded through international mechanisms, they're open to international verification. But again, it's early days yet to make a call and say that this is how it'll end up.
Right. But if going by that policy or your characterization of the Indian policy, if the only purview of the international community to enforce is efforts that are funded with international funds, that's a tiny fraction. Most of the carbon comes from internal economic forces in places like China, the United States, and India.
Right. But again, we're looking at potential. It's about future emissions, and most of the future emissions are going to come from places like China and India. And India, of course, doesn't have as big a bank as other places, and their view is that a lot of this should be supported through international funding mechanisms. And with that will come the international verification. I think the larger view is that all efforts, domestic and internationally funded, should be managed through international compliance mechanisms. And that's where the gist of it is, where we're having some sort of a problem.
Well, Richie Ahuja, let's talk about why India has a problem with the World Bank. The Danish text suggests that the World Bank would be administering this enforcement mechanism. And again, it's just a draft. But what's the problem with the World Bank?
I would not know how to begin to answer that. I think, again, the so far, the way the negotiations have worked, The developing countries have been asking for a central entity, a new entity, much like the Adaptation Fund Board, to do this. But let's be realistic. I think you'll have different delivery vehicles for financing. And as I said earlier, this is an early iteration of the text. It is not the final be-all and end-all. So we'll see very many revisions in the couple of days to come.
Well, Richie Ahuja, thanks so much for joining us. He's the Indian Program Manager with the Environmental Defense Fund, giving us, to a certain extent, India's reaction to this so-called Danish text, which refers to the very complex issue at the climate change talks of compliance. We join now by Andrew Revkin, who's environmental reporter for The New York Times, who's in Copenhagen. We just got a sense of this controversy and debate and really the tiptoeing around the idea that this is a draft. Compliance is really the extreme bugaboo at this conference, correct?
Yes, just think about the Senate. This all relates basically to the U.S. Senate. For Obama to sign on to anything here that would result in a treaty next year, he's thinking about 67 votes, which is what you need in the United States to have advice and consent of the Senate. That's a lot of votes. Just think, well, you know, you've been covering the health and energy debates. For 60 votes, 67 is a steep hill to climb. That means you really have to pay attention not just to the sort of moderates, but some pretty conservative voices who don't like treaties and who want, if we're going to have money flowing anywhere from our coffers, to have it verifiable. And that's what it's about.
We've been covering this conference all week long. Give us a sense of the politics that are emerging. How are the constituencies operating? How are the sessions going? How much backroom dealing is going on versus public stances?
Well, just to delineate the realities, there are three or four blocks of countries here. There's the poorest of the poor. And for them, everyone has a different definition of global warming and a different definition of what they want out of this treaty, as I've been writing on .earth and in the paper. The poorest countries want money. They feel already vulnerable, if not suffering from climate-related hazards that they assert are the responsibility of everyone who's been pumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere for the last 100 years or two. And then the emerging giants, China and India. India is trying to distance itself from China, which has five times the emissions of India.
Right.
measured in any way. But so China's kind of on its own. It sometimes groups itself with the others. There's this long-lasting institution called the Group of 77 plus China.
Right.
And America basically wants to split India off and split China off and say, you know, you can't do that anymore. You're a big boy now, and you need to kind of come over to our side. You have trillions in capital, and in fact, just today, George Soros, I blogged on him coming here, the financier and philanthropist.
No, he says the amount of money being put up is way, way insufficient. Andrew Refkin, environmental reporter for the New York Times, reporting from Copenhagen, where there at least is talk about setting up an international mechanism for enforcing compliance on climate change. Thanks to Andrew. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Let's move from Europe to Mexico now, where drug and gang violence has claimed more than 7,000 lives just this year alone. In response, the Mexican government has deployed thousands of military troops in total since 2006. Mexican President Felipe Calderon has deployed 45,000 troops to step in and fill the security vacuum that was left by local, state, and federal police. But Amnesty International says those military troops that are supposed to be protecting citizens are themselves guilty of human rights abuses. We're returned once again by Dudley Althaus. He's the Mexico City bureau chief for the Houston Chronicle and covered this story for the paper. Welcome back, Dudley.
Hi, Celeste. Good morning.
Amnesty International is claiming that there are 2,500 complaints lodged against military troops that are largely going ignored. Correct?
Yeah, Amnesty's figure came from the Mexico's National Human Rights Commission, which is a semi-autonomous government body. There are 2,500 in recent years, but the human rights group says only a few dozen of those are serious complaints that they're investigating.
And another thing that Amnesty International points to is that they're tried rather secretively in military courts, that these complaints are never truly addressed, and they're asking the Mexican government to move these trials into open civilian court.
Yeah, that's been a long-standing complaint from human rights groups, Human Rights Watch, and Mexican groups have long complained about the opaque nature of the military courts. The military claims all these trials are open, but it's very hard to get access to them.
Some of these complaints are really severe. There was a man who was picked up by soldiers and then his body was found later. He died from a brain hemorrhage. What is going on here? Did they perhaps, in the rush to get more troops on the streets, pick up people who perhaps were not prepared for the duty?
Well, in places like Juarez, in general, Army soldiers are not policemen. They've been put into the field out of necessity, according to the Mexican government, but they're not policemen. And so there have been abuses in the neighborhoods of Juarez, where the fighting has been the worst. They have picked up a lot of young men and taken them out in the outskirts of town and tortured, and sometimes a few people have been killed.
The president, Felipe Calderon, has responded to the criticism. You quote him in the paper saying that these are voices that disingenuously suggest the government simply withdraw from this fight. Is there any truth to that statement, that these are complaints from people who want the government to stop fighting gang wars?
Well, I think he was referring not only to the human rights groups, but also other political opponents who have said that this is not working. And, in fact, the Army has not proved capable of really stopping the violence in places like Juarez. That said, I think Calderon's kind of all in on this, and the Army is the only tool he's got, really.
It's all or nothing for Calderon. He doesn't have an option.
Well, he really doesn't have an option yet. They're training some federal police and state police forces, but the local and state police and the federal police are really not capable of dealing with this. So the Army's in the field, and at times it's open combat here.
And that's exactly why Amnesty International is trying to bring international attention to the problem. That's Dudley Althaus, Mexico City bureau chief for the Houston Chronicle, talking about numerous complaints, 2,500 of them, Amnesty International claims, against military troops committing human rights abuses against civilians in Mexico.
Good morning. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, we're going to update you on a story disturbing involving five men being interrogated in Pakistan who disappeared from Washington. It could possibly be a terrorist allegation or a terrorist investigation. And also, Atlanta has a new mayor. More on all of those in just a moment. But let's have a check on leading stories. At just about 48 minutes after the hour, President Obama is now officially a Nobel laureate. In his acceptance speech, he spoke about the two wars currently being waged by the United States, saying he had an acute sense of the cost of armed conflict and called the war in Afghanistan a just war. Here's a clip from this morning's lecture.
I receive this honor with deep gratitude and great humility. It's an award that speaks to our highest aspirations, that for all the cruelty and hardship of our world, we are not mere prisoners of fate. Our actions matter and can bend history in the direction of justice.
We have fresh economic news out this morning. The Labor Department says the number of newly laid off workers filing for unemployment insurance rose by 17,000 last week. That's higher than expected. But the number of people continuing to claim benefits fell to just over 5 million. That's the lowest level since February. The U.S. trade deficit unexpectedly narrowed in October as exports surged to the highest level in nearly a year. Growing exports propped by a weaker dollar are expected to boost demand for American manufactured goods in coming months. And foreclosures were down again last month with an 8% decrease, but Rick Sharga of Realty Track says foreclosure rates are still high.
We're looking at historically unprecedented levels of foreclosure activity, even though the month-to-month numbers are a little lower than they have been.
Foreclosure filings are still up 18% from a year ago. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
And a happy ending in Atlanta. There's a new mayor down there. More on that in just a moment. There's a rally going on Wall Street this morning. The Dow is up almost 100 points. But a disturbing story out of Washington and Pakistan. Scott Shane joins us. He's national security reporter for the New York Times. Scott, you reported this morning in the Times that story of five young Muslim American men detained in Pakistan, believed to be the same five men who vanished from Washington, D.C. last month, possibly part of some recruiting efforts of some terrorist organization. Scott, the details, as far as you know them.
Yes, it remains quite mysterious, and it's possible, certainly, that there is no terrorism or intended terrorism involved in this case. But it certainly has alarmed their families and their community. These are five guys ranging in age from upper teens to early 20s who disappeared at the end of November. And their families were alarmed, contacted local Muslim leaders and a Muslim organization, which met with them. And among other things, one of the families had discovered an 11-minute video made by their son in which he appeared to be saying goodbye, and it showed pictures of fighting, and he called on Muslims to defend their faith. And it was not exactly a martyrdom video, according to people who've seen it, but it was an alarming thing. So the families and the Muslim organization that was helping them went to the FBI. The FBI started looking for these guys, and it turned out they had flown to Pakistan, arriving on December 1st. We're told that one of the young men has a father who is associated with a banned Pakistani militant group. And that the five of them made their way eventually to the father's house, and that's where Pakistani police picked them up.
Wow, Scott Shane. Final question: any indication that the FBI has access to these individuals? We do understand that the Pakistani authorities are interrogating them.
That's right. The FBI had flown a team out there, and the FBI agents were on their way to try to talk to them yesterday.
All right, but again, no confirmation if they've actually been able to ask them questions, right?
No, I don't know that.
All right,
at this point.
Well, that's certainly the thing to pick up and follow. Scott Shane, national security reporter for the New York Times, reporting on five young Muslim American men detained in Pakistan, the same five men apparently who vanished from Washington, D.C. last month.
And now we'll go to Atlanta. There is finally a winner in the mayor's race there. They've been waiting for a long time because this could have been, had had the potential to be, the first time Atlanta elected a white mayor in more than three decades. That didn't happen. Joining us now is Ricky Bevington from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. The runoff was finally settled yesterday. Ricky, was it a decisive victory for Kasim Reed?
It was a decisive victory in that, yes, he is the winner, Celeste, but guess what? He only beat Mary Norwood by 714 votes.
So what does that tell us about the voters in Atlanta? When you brought us reactions from people in the city, they said this race was not about
race. Has that turned out to be the case?
It really seems to have. Well, I would like to say that it's the case. When you look at the maps of voting districts and how people voted, they largely voted along racial lines. However, Mary Norwood did about 20% in some of the primarily black districts. Kasim Reed did about 20% in the primarily white districts. There's one district, only one, where that was not the case. More white voters than black registered voters. 22% voter turnout. Kasim Reed beat Mary Norwood by 41 votes in a primarily white district. However, Kasim Reed says, regardless of how, if Atlantans think they are post-racial, I am going to be a post-racial administration. He did not use those words. I shouldn't put them in his mouth. But he does say he could consider bringing Mary Norwood into his cabinet.
Huh. I mean, you talked to him when we spoke to with you last week about this race, that in some sense this is a confrontation between the Atlanta political machine and an attempt to, if not take power, share power. How does that look this morning?
This morning, it looks like all of the analysis is that the Atlanta political machine technically is churning forward as it always have with, as it always has with the continuation of an African American mayor. However, both candidates, and Kasim Reed included, campaigned on a message of change. Absolutely, even his African-American support want that change. So, yes, he's black, like he has, you know, like there's always been a black mayor since the 1970s. However, Kasim Reed says beyond race, there will be change, so that machine will see changes.
So, Ricky Bevington, the Secretary of State has launched an investigation into this mayor's race. Does that mean that this long, long-standing race that the Atlanta citizens must be so happy is finally over? Does that mean it's not really over?
It doesn't, Celeste. Yesterday, a group of Norwood supporters came to the Secretary of State's office. They said, we have 1,300 votes from people registered at public housing projects and apartments that were raised. They no longer exist. These people voted in the original election, not the runoff, the general election, November 3rd. But yesterday, they apologized, Celeste. They said, oops, they didn't vote. They were only registered, only about 30 or 40 people actually voted, so it wouldn't make a difference.
Kasim Reed, the winner in Atlanta. Ricky Bevington is the executive producer at Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Well, all morning long we've been talking about Barack Obama accepting the Nobel Peace Prize. He used these words to conclude, let us reach for the world that ought to be. Well, you were reaching to us to react, to hear some voices from our program. 2004 Nobel Peace Prize winner Wangari Maathai.
It's going to take the goodwill of the people of the United States of America, who obviously also put him there because they had hope in him. It's also going to take the goodwill of the world, which also celebrated his election and who to whom he has given so much hope. So alone he cannot do it, but with a lot of people, a lot of governments in the world that want a more peaceful world, we can achieve it. And he just happens to be the right person of the right country at this time.
If you want to hear the whole speech, you can go to thetakeaway.org. We've got it there on the website. You can stream it. We also heard from House Speaker Newt Gingrich.
The president, I think, did a very good job of representing the role of America, which has been that of, at the risk of lives of young Americans, creating the fabric of security within which you could have a Martin Luther King Jr. or you could have a Mahatma Gandhi.
We had reactions from lots of people today, experts, analysts, and you.
I don't think that Obama has earned the Nobel Peace Prize.
He's had to make his big Afghanistan decision. Within the past couple of months, it has just raised the bar for what this award means.
I don't think Obama has to do anything more.
Clearly, there was a great deal of expectation and support for him, particularly in the Muslim world.
You know, the problem of President Barack Obama with the Middle East is that he created a lot of expectation.
It is a high-stakes moment, and it's one in which the president has a huge opportunity to clearly express what he means when he extends this hope to the world for peace.
It's a grown-up speech that tries to deal with some of the very real dilemmas, contradictions, tensions of out a global foreign policy.
He'll be judged by his presidency, not by this speech here in Oslo today.
I believe that President Obama is doing just the right thing, modeling and empowering everyone in the world to move towards peace.
I think what's left to be discussed is what is he going to do with this Nobel Peace Prize? Is he going to continue talks about nuclear disarmament? Is this going to help him get things passed through Congress? What exactly is going to come from this?
That's all the people we've heard from this morning, like you. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.